were glancing over the newsstands, you might have seen this week's edition of Newsweek and its cover story, The War Over Fetal Rights. There are some pictures, and these have also been circulating on the web. MSNBC had these pictures up as well. Pictures taken by the latest, the cutting-edge imaging technology inside the womb. They are remarkable. They are pictures of a fetus, a baby, at the size of a grape at 7 weeks, one at 10 weeks, one at 21, and one at 23. And I'll tell you what, by the time you get to 10, looks like a baby to me. It's indiscernible in the other one, but it still is a baby. This debate over fetal rights, it has also come to a head with things like, the Violence Against Unborn Victims Act and things like that, been renamed for the famous mother and child that were killed on the West Coast. And everyone wonders, where will this come out? Now, we can't answer that question, but we can try and define the debate over fetal rights and over who the unborn really is. We'll do that in the first hour of Issues Etc. today. We are coming to you live this Thursday, the 5th of June. I took yesterday off. It was my wife's birthday. And we had a little rebroadcast of some of the best of Issues Etc. But we're back here live today. We'll be talking first with Scott Klusendorf about the Newsweek article, The War Over Fetal Rights. He's director of bioethics for Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California. We'll be joined in the second hour by one of the co-authors of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, called Christian Ethics in the Workplace. Pastor Phil Lakas will join us to give us a biblical overview of Christian ethics, some basic stuff there, and answer a few of those questions about whether or not workplace ethics differ from Christian ethics. In the third hour of the program, our good friend Bob Leko, co-founder of Discernment Ministry International, based in Detroit, joins us. We'll talk about total depravity and its close theological cousin, original sin, in the third hour of Issues Etc. today. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Scott Klusendorf is a regular guest here and probably best qualified among our stable of guests here on Issues Etc. to talk about the fine points of this very debate, what Newsweek calls the war over fetal rights. Scott, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Todd, it's great to be on the show. Shame on you taking a day off.
That's how I feel. You know, I actually feel guilty when I take a day off.
Gave you the right to do that?
Well, my wife gave me the order.
That's right. That's good enough.
And I didn't need rights after that.
That's right.
I just needed marching orders.
Orders trump rights any day of the week.
Especially when they come from the wife.
That's exactly right.
Now, you've seen the Newsweek article. How would you define this debate, what they call the war over fetal rights?
Well, you know, this Newsweek article, which is the cover story, as you mentioned, has some very good things in it. Of course, you know, as you read through it with a discerning eye, you're going to see your usual laundry list of pro-abortion cliches creeping up here and there. But on balance, they do present what is the crux of the issue. And here's what the crux of the issue is. How are we as a culture going to define human beings? Are they intrinsically valuable in virtue of the kind of thing they are? Or are they only valuable for what they can do functionally? Put another way, do human beings have rights in virtue of the kind of thing they are, or only because they have some acquired property like consciousness or sentience or some ability to process information or be aware of their environment? And the Newsweek article does present that debate. And they do so, I think, in a reasonably even-handed way. I was a little surprised that the series of articles in Newsweek were not a little more stacked toward the other side. In fact, one could make the argument that this particular cover story, really, in terms of imagery and in terms of the amount of text given to the stories, really makes our side look better. I mean, they certainly don't present Kate Michelman, head of the National Abortion Rights Action League, in a very favorable light. When they quote some of the philosophers they cite who are in favor of abortion, I thought the quotes that they present were just pathetic, and yet when they quoted some of our guys like Hadley Arkus, I mean, Hadley just hit it out of the park. So there's a lot to like here.
All right. Has this debate, in a sense, changed since the very prominent double murder case out in California of Lacey and Connor, that now their names have been added to the Unborn Victims of Violence Act as the unofficial name of the bill. Has that kind of nation-gripping event changed people's minds or the contours of this debate?
It hasn't by itself done that, but it's added weight to a cumulative case the pro-life movement has been working on for, I would say, the better part of a decade since we first introduced legislation on partial birth abortion in the early 1990s. What I would say is this. Some pro-lifers right now are quite giddy this week. They're quite excited. They're saying, look, this is proof we're winning. I think that's overstating the facts. We're not winning yet. What's happening is we are being given an opportunity to reintroduce our case to the public. The public is now looking at some things like the Peterson case, like partial birth abortion, like cloning, like embryo stem cell research. These were supposed to be settled issues. I mean, 10 years ago, Todd, abortion rights advocates were looking at a pro-abortion president, both houses of Congress solidly pro-abortion, the majority of governors pro-abortion, the majority of city governments pro-abortion. I mean, they were looking at a lock on these issues, and they were convinced they were settled. That was it. We can move on now. Well, here we are, and we have anything but settled these issues, and that's good news for our side because the pro-abortion movement wants nothing better than these questions and these issues to just disappear. They don't really want to debate them because when they debate them, they're faced with some very troubling questions, you know, like the issue of the Lacey Peterson case. I mean, think about what they have to defend here. The public is asking this question. The public is basically saying, wait a minute, it's wrong for the husband to kill his wife's child, but okay for the mother to do it through abortion? I mean, that's a great question and one that the Peterson case has certainly helped highlight. But it's only part of a larger series of events that have been allowing us an opportunity to remake our case. And the real question, Todd, is, are we ready as Christians? Are we equipped to persuasively argue our case around the water cooler at work where our coworkers are raising these issues, at church where we're sitting with Christians who are maybe confused on these issues, at school with other students? If we equip ourselves and make a concerted effort to make a gracious and yet persuasive defense for what we believe, then I think when issues like the Peterson case come up, we can seize the opportunity to really make an impact.
Do you think, I mean, as you survey what's generally called the pro-life movement, do you think that Christians and other pro-lifers are adequately equipped to have that water cooler conversation, that conversation sitting there across the back fence or you know, around the barbecue grill? Do you think they're really equipped at this point?
Well, I can't answer it empirically because there's not been a study done, but I can tell you anecdotally from my speaking around the nation, what I hear again and again and again is people come up to me and say, well, I've been pro-life for 20 years but never knew how to express my view, or I've always felt that what you said was right but never knew how I could answer critics. That tells me that as a movement, we have not firmed up our own foundation with our own foot soldiers. We've not equipped them to be persuasive defenders of our view in the public square, and that is not a good thing. Now, I think due to the grace and sovereignty of God, even though we've not been prepared, we have not been wiped off the face of the map, and I'm thankful for that, and I'm very grateful we're getting a chance to reintroduce our case, but we got to be ready for it.
Now, you had mentioned before Hadley Arkus. He's featured in the sidebar of the Newsweek article. And then on the next page is a composition to Hadley's pro-life position.
Bonnie Steinbeck, yeah.
Right. Now, this is, you mentioned this just a minute ago, but I want you to take this apart, if you would, because here is the first question that is asked of her. What rights does a fetus have? Is it a crime victim, that is, the fetus? And her answer is this: I think that context matters tremendously. And she goes on to say, look, if we're talking about the right of a woman to terminate a pregnancy, then we're talking about the status of the fetus, whether it's legally a person, whether it's a moral person. When we're talking about an attack on a pregnant woman, then those issues are no longer relevant. She argues that if you were to kill a fetus in the course of committing a crime of violence, then that fetus should have legal protections or recourse. But if a woman goes to the abortion clinic, the fetus doesn't deserve any protections.
Right.
How would you respond to what appears to me to be an untenable position here by this woman?
Well, the first thing to do is clarify all the mumbo-jumbo she's thrown out here. Look, here's her position. The fetus is a person with rights if it's wanted by the mother. If it's not wanted by the mother, it has no rights. That's her position. And she draws this phony distinction between legal personhood and biological human life, and whether it's a moral person or just a physical human being. I mean, this is all nonsense. But it's the way... See, here's what happens. You look at any act or any genocidal action in history, and you will find those that are committing the crimes or defending those who are committing the crimes always using language to define their victims as less than fully human. And personhood is an arbitrary term we come up with to distinguish a class of human beings who have rights from a class of human beings that don't. I think pro-lifers would be wise to drop all talk of personhood from their vocabulary, because it's really not the issue. The question is, what makes human beings valuable? Do human beings have rights in virtue of the kind of thing they are, meaning members of a natural kind, human beings, or do they only have rights when they acquire a certain arbitrarily selected degree of development, like the ability to experience conscious memories or thoughts? See, these are things that people use to distinguish persons from non-persons, and they're totally arbitrary. And I would ask someone like Ms. Steinbeck here, I'd say, wait a minute, you say there's such a thing as a human being that's not a person. Why should we accept that claim? Have you ever met a human being that wasn't a person? Now, of course, Todd, some of your listeners who have teenagers may say yes, but in reality, you and I both know that all human beings, by definition, are persons. So this arbitrary distinction is just a way for her to dance around the question.
Our guest is Scott Klusendorf. He's director of bioethics for Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California. We're talking about this week's Newsweek magazine cover story titled The War Over Fetal Rights. Feel free to join us with your questions or comments. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Let's take a caller here early in the conversation. Kathy from St. Charles, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'd like to ask your guest, Scott, about the issues that he's talking about in regards to personhoodness for people with special needs. You know, a lot of Christians are very much behind the pro-life stance, but they may not be willing to pay taxes to help, higher taxes to help families support children with special needs. And those issues are really life issues that a lot of people really don't look at like that. They look at economic issue, and a lot of states are cutting programs for families and those type of people because they're not voters, they're not contributors. And so, you know, these are life issues, and pro-life people need to get behind these issues as well, because, you know, there again, do pro-lifers do this in a sense where they say, well, these people aren't contributors, so I don't want to pay taxes for them?
Kathy, thank you for raising that concern. Your reaction to that?
Well, Kathy raises a very good point, and that is, what should be the role of government in caring for those who have trouble caring for themselves, and is there a role for government in that? That's a legitimate debate, but it is separate from the moral question of abortion. The moral question of abortion comes down to one issue. Is what we're proposing to kill a member of the human family? If it is, the reasons we give to justify killing that human being stand or fall apart from whether pro-lifers do their job in other areas. For example, let's say I were to argue 4 days a week that abortion is a moral wrong and you ought not do it. But then 2 days a week, I go to work as an abortionist where I actually kill fetuses to pay my bills. Now, one could certainly point out that I was inconsistent, and indeed I would be. But would it follow that my arguments during the week that abortion is wrong are somehow flawed? No, the arguments stand or fall apart from my behavior. So I agree with Kathy that there's an important discussion we need to have about how we care for members of the society and culture who cannot care for themselves, but it doesn't follow that the argument against abortion is somehow compromised if pro-lifers aren't behaving in ways that other people think they ought to. And there's another danger here. I think we need to be careful that we not force the pro-life movement to be responsible for more things than it ought to be responsible for. No one would go to the American Cancer Institute and say, you have no right to oppose cancer unless you're willing to stop all forms of death, including heart attacks, diabetes, children being run over on tricycles, and people who drowned in swimming pools, for example. No one would say that to the American Cancer Institute because we recognize they have a specific role to play confronting a specific disease that needs treatment. Well, I think the same is true with those who oppose abortion. We are fighting a specific evil in the culture. We don't have the resources to fight everything that's out there. But Kathy's point is still legitimate in that as a culture as a whole, we ought to have these kinds of discussions. My only concern is that we not link it to the morality of abortion, because the morality of abortion comes down to just one question: what is that thing we want to kill?
So in other words, Kathy's concern here, of course, Kathy does not raise an objection to the pro-life position.
No, not at all. Right.
But her concern here is that that pro-lifers ought to be consistently, and as individuals, consistently pro-life, and that is to think about the life issue not only with regard to abortion, but through life in these unique circumstances, and also all the way to the end of life, that as individuals, it only bolsters our integrity, our personal integrity, not the integrity of our arguments per se, but our personal integrity, to be completely consistent on the issue of life from beginning to end.
Yes, it does, although I want to issue one caveat here. There are pro-life groups out here that on Monday night they fight abortion, Tuesday night they fight school abuses, Wednesday night they fight the deforestation of the Amazon, Thursday night they're out helping the homeless, and I think you get the picture. They have spread themselves so thinly that they're not being effective in any one area. Frederick the Great put it real well, he who attacks everywhere attacks nowhere. And I think the most important task for the pro-life movement now is to bring moral clarity to the question, what makes a human being valuable? Why does that fetus not count? Well, we think it does count. What are our reasons for thinking it counts? And giving moral clarity on that question is the thing that's going to cause the culture to reexamine its viewpoint on issues like abortion. That's why the Lacey Peterson case has been helpful, because it brings moral clarity to these questions. It causes people to stop and go, wait a minute. What are we doing here? So I agree with Kathy that we do need to, as Christians and as people concerned about those who are vulnerable and defenseless, we have a duty to help them. But I think we need to be very careful as pro-lifers of conceding the ground that our case is only legitimate insofar as we are doing things on these other issues. That is not something I'm willing to concede.
Somebody says, look, you called this question, who is the unborn, a moral question. They might counter, no, Scott, it's really just a philosophical question. It has no moral implications. Fine, we can argue about who the unborn is, but in the morality of this is going to be a whole different consideration. That we're going to have to take everybody's rights into account, and that is, even if the person who's going to say this, Scott, even if the fetus is a person and a human being, the woman's right to choose might make it moral to abort the child.
Well, people love to say that this is just a philosophical question where we have to take all points of view into consideration or something like that. You know, first of all, the fact that people disagree and that there's various views out there, it doesn't follow from that nobody's correct. As you know, Todd, people once disagreed on the issue of slavery. It didn't follow that nobody was right. When someone says to me, well, this is just a philosophical debate with no real moral consequence, I like to remind people that philosophy and ideas have consequences. Nazi Germany first bought into a philosophy and then applied it morally in the gas chambers. So ideas have consequences, and it's not just a benign exercise in tossing around opinions as it comes to issues like abortion. These are real important moral discussions that we have to make our case for. As far as someone saying, look, I don't care if the unborn is human, I'm going to kill it anyway because the mother has a right to choose. At that point, when someone is willing to concede it's a human being like you and I, and yet it has no right to live, and they just want to arbitrarily kill it because the mother says so, I think at that point, that person doesn't need an argument. They need a psychologist, because what they're basically saying is, I have no obligation to respect the rights of another human being that I will even concede is a human being. My will and my wants supersede any moral standard. There's a name for that. It's called a sociopath.
There is. I'm thinking about the average woman who has, through whatever circumstances, found herself in the in the abortion clinic, and she's going to have the abortion she does.
Right.
Given the statistics we know about post-abortion trauma that women suffer, the kind of guilt, their need at a much higher rate for psychological help afterwards because they're depressed, they are guilty, you name it. It's hard for me to believe that the average woman who has an abortion doesn't really believe that this baby is a baby, a human being, but they're allowing the considerations of their rights, their circumstances, their fears about the future to override what they know is right here.
Yeah. And keep in mind my comment a moment ago about people conceding the unborn or human and saying, I'm going to kill it anyway. I'm talking not about a woman who's in a crisis pregnancy and facing all kinds of struggles and maybe even coming to the wrong decisions. I'm talking about someone who philosophically concedes the premise of the pro-life movement and says, I don't care about morality. I'm just going to do what I want to do. That's the person who is flirting with a sociopath personality. But back to the woman who is actually in this dilemma, I think that there is some truth to the statement that women who have abortions know what they're doing and that they think it's wrong. But I question whether they believe it's seriously wrong. And I'll tell you why I think that, Todd. Women do not kill their two-year-olds when they're faced with practical problems, like how am I going to pay for my living expenses? How am I going to continue with school? How am I going to feed the family? They only kill their fetuses when confronted with these problems, which tells me that the way they view their fetuses is fundamentally different than the way they view their toddlers or their newborns. So I'm not so sure I agree with the premise that, the culture agrees with the pro-life movement that killing a fetus is the same as killing a born child. I think there clearly is a difference in people's minds. In fact, the San Francisco Chronicle ran a poll not too long ago showing that in the state of California, people overwhelmingly support first trimester abortion precisely because they believe the fetus at that point of development is not a full human being.
We're talking with Scott Klusendorf, Director of Bioethics for Stand to Reason, and we're talking, reacting to and using as a springboard the Newsweek magazine cover story from this week titled The War Over Fetal Rights. When we come back from this break, I'm looking at these pictures, and they're compelling. The latest of insonogram and imaging technology now shows us the average baby in the womb without any invasive procedures in 3D, in real time, in a way that it is unmistakable to conclude this is a baby. There's no two ways about it. Now, Scott is fond of trotting out the toddler when it comes to making the argument against abortion. We'll find out what that argument is, and we'll find out whether or not these pictures, in effect, pictures worth a thousand words, trot out the toddler when you can actually see the baby in the womb and can no longer say, wow, that's a fetus, but you are forced to say by the images you see, wow, that's a baby, whether or not the toddler has also been trotted out. Stay with us.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues, etc.
Perhaps you've heard someone say, right and wrong are all fine and good, but this is business. Is the place of business any place for Christian ethics? How does the Christian square the profit motive, the bottom line, and business competition with Christian ethics? In our Issues, etc. book of the month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace, its authors explore these very questions and, through case studies, show how Christian ethics work in the workplace. You can receive your copy by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. The book costs $14.99 plus shipping and handling. Or order online at our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on this book. When you call or write, be sure to ask for the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June, Christian Ethics in the Workplace, 1-800-325-3040.
focuses prayer on an area in India where a small number of people are responding to the gospel. There's an area in India called Achankoville, which is described as a primitive area and predominantly Hindu. A crusade was held recently through India Evangelical Mission, and three Hindu families came to embrace Christ as their Savior. IEM will help the families get connected with local churches. Hindus who choose to embrace Christ as their Savior make a stunning decision. In some areas, Hindu families risk their reputations, their family relationships, and even their jobs if it's learned they've changed their religious beliefs. Pray for Hindu families in India to learn about Christ so they can set aside their idols and gods. Pray for India by getting a free brochure called To India with Love. Call 1-800-268-0461. That's 1-800-268-0461.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Let's do a news quiz. Why is Sammy Sosa in the news? Does Martha Stewart think her name in the news is a good thing? Why is Hillary Clinton getting special attention? How'd you do? Sammy Sosa caught with a corked bat. Martha Stewart threatened with prosecution. Not a good thing. Hillary Clinton wrote about Bill's infidelity. I'm sure you did well. We like to follow the problems of high-profile people. Now to my real point. I'll bet if you ask churchgoers what one or two things they are struggling with in their relationship with God, most couldn't give you an immediate answer. Of course, that's very subjective on my part, but I've tried it in my preaching. Right now, I say, can you list one or two spiritual struggles you are having? The reaction on the faces in the crowd suggests their answer is no. We can identify what's going on with superstars in the news. We can identify our own physical, material struggles. But when it comes to the most important news of all, our relationship with God, many of us haven't thought about what's going on. Something to think about.
How can you go to fun and exciting places like Six Flags, Merrimack Caverns, the City Museum, and get paid for it? By working at Life Skills Foundation's Summer Adventures Club. Life Skills Foundation is currently seeking camp counselors to work at the summer camp, the Summer Adventures Club. This 11-week summer camp runs from June 9th through August 15th, 8 until 5, Monday through Friday. And the camp is specifically designed for teens with and without disabilities. Contact the Life Skills Foundation.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're halfway through a conversation with Scott Klusendorf, Director of Bioethics for Stand to Reason, talking about the Newsweek article, you may have seen it yourself, cover story, in fact, the war over fetal rights and the amazing images that were printed there, tracking the baby from the very earliest stages of the pregnancy all the way through the full term. It is remarkable to see these images, and apparently these are the kind of things that a woman will be seeing very near in the future when she goes to her OBGYN, and perhaps even available in abortion clinics where they do sonograms as well. I wonder if the women will be allowed to see them there. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Scott, these images that appear in Newsweek, and they've been circulating around the web, you talk about trotting out the toddler, and that is substituting, you did it just a few minutes ago, substituting the two-year-old for the fetus in the argument for killing one's child. Do these images, in effect, so unmistakably a baby, do they trot out the toddler?
Well, they don't trot out the toddler. They do something else. And trotting out the toddler is important. We can discuss that in just a moment. But what these images do is they make it impossible for the culture to trivialize abortion. Now, Newsweek printed half of the equation. They printed nice pictures of children in the womb. That's important. I would have loved it if they had actually gone a step further, and had they been totally committed to the Socratic quest for truth, I think they would have done this, and that would have been to present some images of aborted children. After all, that is what the debate's about. When we talk about the Nazi Holocaust, we don't print pictures of nice little Jewish children dressed up in nice little, Sabbath clothes. What we do is we present bodies stacked like cordwood to show the atrocities that were committed against innocent human beings. And that's appropriate because that's what the nature of the discussion is about. However, that being said, at least the Newsweek article does show one of the most important photos, I think, that needed to be seen, and that is the picture of the hand coming out of the womb when you see the example of baby Samuel. And it's right there in Newsweek on page 48. They did a surgery on baby Samuel while he was still in the womb. What they did is partially remove the mother's uterus, and they went in and did a special surgery to correct a defect he had that had to do with his brain having fluid in it. And they went in there and they did the correction, and while they were doing it, his hand popped out of the womb and grabbed the finger of the attending physician. And that picture is right there in Newsweek. And then they show a picture of Samuel right adjacent to it, where he is now a toddler. And it is a great, great picture. Now, this does trot out the toddler. In this sense, you are forced to admit that the fetus whose hand is coming out of this woman's abdomen is the same entity that's standing on the front lawn grinning in the picture right next to it. In other words, you can't reasonably deny that they're separate entities. They are one in the same. And that is a very important point for the pro-life argument, and that is that you and I are identical to the fetus we once were. We didn't evolve from a fetus. We didn't come from a zygote. We once were a zygote. We once were a fetus. And this picture, better than, I suppose, a 300-word argument could do, illustrates that profound, profound truth.
How do you respond to this? And this is another argument put forth by the pro-choice community, and that is, look, regardless of the issue of who the unborn is, if we pursue something like fetal rights in legislation, that will necessarily lead to an erosion of the rights of mothers.
Yeah, you know, this is exactly the same kind of talk we heard from white racists in the South prior to passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. There were white business owners arguing, look, we don't care if blacks are human beings with rights. The real issue here is, what's this going to do to our economy when we're forced to hire people who are dark? What's it going to do to us and our rights as business owners to decide who we hire and who we don't? In other words, they totally ignored the question of whether the African American deserved rights in virtue of the kind of thing he was, and jumped right ahead to the question of, well, how is this going to impact me personally? And that's exactly what's going on here. You get Kate Michaelman of the National Abortion Rights Action League saying that she is very disturbed by this Lacey Peterson case because it's part of a larger strategy to establish the embryo with a separate, distinct rights equal to or greater than the mother. Well, that just sounds so incredibly callous. I mean, imagine her standing in front of the parents of Lacey Peterson and saying, you know what, you need to just give up this love affair you have with your daughter and her unborn child, because what you're doing by putting the focus on that child is you're putting our rights in jeopardy. I mean, that's exactly what she's saying, and it's callous. It is hurting their side of the debate to say that, and I hope they keep saying things like this.
What I found unbelievably ironic about the Michaelman, there's a Michaelman picture with a quote, it's so crass, so offensive, it's part of a larger strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And she's reacting to the change of the name of the bill, Unborn Victims of Violence Act, to the Lacey and Conner Law, when she is, in fact, the president of NARAL that just changed its name to NARAL Pro-Choice America, leaving the acronym of NARAL, which includes the word abortion, unexplained.
Yeah. You know, I'm always amazed at these so-called pro-abortion groups, because if abortion is such a great thing, why are they ashamed of it? You know, they're always out there saying, well, we want to cut down the number of abortions. We want to make abortion safe, legal, and rare. And my question is, why do you want to make it rare? If it's no big deal the way you say it is, who cares if there's 80 billion abortions a year or none at all? I mean, really, it really shows something about their own inability to be confident in what they're defending. They are standing on a house of cards. They know it, and I'm convinced that if Christians can mobilized to make a case for their view, and that requires us being skilled apologists on the pro-life issue. Doesn't take a lot of hard work. It just means some consistent review of what our case is. This is the kind of thing that we can start to take down, these cards that are stacked up with nothing really supporting them. It's a bunch of cliches, and in fact, Jonah Goldberg of National Review had a great article 5 or 6 months ago, something to do with how we've become a culture of cliches, and cliches have replaced arguments. And what we need to do as Christians is follow the advice of 1 Peter 3:15 and always be ready to give an answer for the hope that lies within us. That word give an answer in the Greek is the Greek word apologia, which has to do with making a case the way a lawyer would in a court of law. And that's exactly what we need to do here, is bring secular arguments, hard-hitting philosophic and scientific arguments to the front of this debate and show that our arguments are better than the other side's arguments.
Let's go back to the phones, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Matt is up next, calling from Richmond Heights. Hi, Matt.
Hello, Pastor Todd. And this is a great program. It's very informative. And I ran into a little bumper sticker that on the internet the other day that I thought would be appropriate for this. It says, "If a mother can kill her own child, how can we tell others not to kill?" And The other side's argument is that it's not a child, or it's,
right,
not killing, but we all know that that's the case. And so it sets an example. Abortion is a huge example. Why should men not sock their wives when they do something wrong or backtalk them? Or, you know, why couldn't a man just smack his wife right in the face?
Matt, thank you very much for the call.
Yeah.
There is no shortage of, you were just talking about cliches, in fact, Scott. There's no shortage of pithy statements, mm-hmm, on both sides of this argument. What do you make of the one that Matt brought us, and its argument, its implicit argument?
Well, the logic of it is very similar to what Mother Teresa argued at the presidential prayer breakfast when, in front of Bill and Hillary Clinton and numerous Democrats who support abortion, she made the comment that any culture that tolerates unjustified killing in the womb is going to have trouble stopping unjustified killing in the culture at large. Her point is a sound one. I don't have a problem with it at all. And as far as the bumper sticker goes, I think the question it raises is a good one. Behind that, though, is a larger philosophical debate over what makes human beings valuable. And why is it wrong to slug your wife in the stomach? And why would it be wrong to kill your unborn offspring simply because it's in the way and can't defend itself? Well, that's a philosophical question that we as Christians must be prepared to answer. And I think what we need to do as evangelicals especially, we need to become more comfortable with the concept of natural rights. Evangelicals tend to throw out natural law, natural theology, natural rights as being extra-biblical things that get in the way of the gospel. And I reject that notion. I think in today's secular culture, you have got to be able to articulate reasons for what you believe that will be acceptable to people who reject Scripture as a source of authority. And when it comes to the question of what makes us a subject of rights, there's really only two possibilities. We either have rights because the government says so, or we have rights simply because we're human, and we call those natural rights. Natural rights are those rights you and I have, Todd, simply because we're human beings. And Hadley Arkus has written an incredible book called Natural Rights and the Right to Choose that deals with this question. People say a woman has a right to an abortion. Number one, where did that right come from? And number two, when did she get that right? Well, if the right to an abortion is something the government grants, then that means the government is free to take that right away and say women don't have a right to an abortion, and that's the end of the debate. Well, what abortion rights advocates do at that point is say, no, women have a natural right, a fundamental right, as women to have an abortion. Well, Hadley Arkus says, okay, fine. When did the woman get that natural right?
Oh, this is brilliant.
Well, natural rights come to be the moment you come to be. Well, when did you and I come to be? At the moment of conception, which means then a woman has a fundamental natural right to an abortion from the moment she's conceived, which means we have an incredible paradox here.
That is a brilliant argument. That is just hands down one of the most clarifying arguments I have yet to hear, because the woman would be forced to say, if she was consistent and pro-choice, well, that right accrued to me the moment I took my first breath and the umbilical cord was cut. But before that, I didn't have any rights.
Yeah, well, at that point, though, see, she's not arguing natural rights. She's arguing that I have a right at birth because that's when the government has said I have a right. Well, the same government could decide you don't have a right to an abortion. You know, Arcus's book is just fabulous. It's called Natural Rights and the Right to Choose, and it is great. In fact, if I could give two recommendations here, I think that some of your more sophisticated readers on the abortion issue would have no trouble with Arcus's book, and I think even those not sophisticated would get enough of it to find it meaningful. And if they combine that with perhaps my book, Pro-Life 101, which they can get from STR, from Stand to Reason, I think those two resources could really help them with questions like that.
We've had Hadley on the program before and are trying desperately to get him back on the program, especially since he's featured in this Newsweek article.
Scott, he is fabulous.
Scott Klusendorf is our guest, director of bioethics for Stand to Reason. Now, you can check out the website for Stand to Reason. Simply go first to our Issues Etc. website, issuesetc.org. Under the section titled Links with Regular Guests, you're going to find a direct link to Greg Kokel and Stand to Reason. Or if you'd like to receive their free Solid Ground newsletter or other resources, call Stand to Reason at 1-800-2-REASON. 1-800-2-REASON. Let's go back to the phones. Larry is calling from Collinsville. Larry, thank you for waiting. Welcome to Issues Etc.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. You know, you guys just, you just blow me away. It's just, what you're saying is so clear and just so to the point and so powerful, and I appreciate it. I love being here in St. Louis that I can listen to this. But then at night I turn on the TV, for example, or the radio, and when these issues come up, the experts they have on for the pro-life side, either, I don't know, it's just, it's not clear. I don't know if it's, you know, the lights, they're blinded or something. Why is it that this kind of reasoning isn't available? You know, I mean, Bill O'Reilly might be fair and balanced, for example, and you can argue point, you know, each time he makes a point. But, you know, it's just not clear. I mean...
Well, it's a good question, Larry.
Good question, Larry. And I think I may have an answer for you. The medium of television itself is hostile to sophisticated discourse like we're having on this show. Television is quick images, quick sound bites. The image trumps the content. That is the number one rule of television. So and this is a great point, by the way, that's brought out by Dr. Neil Postman in his book, Amusing Ourselves to Death. He says that when the primary epistemology of the culture, meaning the primary way the culture learns about itself, is through a medium that disallows serious discourse, as television does, you're going to get sound bites, cliches, and the makeup artist will replace the speech writer as the most important person in a presidential campaign. And I think that's right on the money. So when you look at TV, you could have someone who's absolutely brilliant on the pro-life side, but maybe isn't as skilled at giving quick soundbite answers, and it will look like he or she is being wiped out by a more sophisticated opponent. Well, maybe his or her opponent is better on TV, but it doesn't mean the arguments being advanced are better. And I think Christians have an opportunity to, around the marketplace, around the water cooler at work, on the college campus, one-on-one or in small groups, they have time to sit down with people they know and make the case in a carefully measured way, where on television you don't have that ability. So my advice would be, as Christians, yeah, we can despair over the fact that mass media is not with us, and they're not, or we can say, okay, wherever God's placed me, wherever I work, wherever I go to school, I'm going to make sure I'm equipped to make a good case for what I believe. I'm going to read Pro-Life 101. I'm going to, you know, take time to become familiar with arguments like those that Hadley Arkus makes. And by doing that, you can counteract the effects of the media where God has placed you. And if we're all doing that, we're going to make a dent in this. And eventually, we're going to see a breakthrough in the media. You're seeing a meltdown of the New York Times right now. You're seeing the Washington Post in some trouble. You got cable news stations like Fox News, you know, shooting through the roof in terms of ratings. People are reevaluating their media choices, and in the long run, who knows, we may or may not see a shift our way, but in the meantime, it doesn't matter. Wherever God's placed me, I'm going to be an equipped ambassador for the pro-life view.
Okay, I'm standing at the water cooler, and we're having this conversation, and the pro-choicer says, look, I know you. You're a Christian, and all you're making is just a religious argument.
Mm-hmm.
How do you respond?
Well, first of all, how does he know it's religious? Before I even start getting defensive there, I'd like to know what he means by religious. Does he mean I disagree with him, and therefore, by definition, my argument's religious? And by the way, there are many religious pro-abortion groups, like the group RCAR, Religious Coalition for Abortion Rights. They make a theological case for their view. Well, does that mean the pro-choice side is disqualified because it, too, is religious? If I advance scientific and philosophic arguments for my case, you must refute my arguments. You can't simply dismiss them with a label. And that's what a lot of people try to do.
This question that we have been talking about and talking around for the entire hour, who is the unborn, seems to sweep along with it almost every other issue that has to do with life, be it in vitro fertilization or cloning, mm-hmm. stem cell research, or mm-hmm. also if you can scale back the rights of the unborn depending on how long they've been in the womb, can't we also scale back the rights of the elderly depending on how close to death mm-hmm. they are? What at the very heart of this should the Christian know, if they know simply one thing in answer to the question, who is the unborn, what should their basic answer be?
Their answer should be that the unborn is a genetically distinct, living, whole human being with no essential difference between you and I. In other words, the fetus we once were and the adults we are today, there is no essential difference between our fetal cells and our adult cells. Sure, there's differences of size, for example. You know, we were smaller back then, but that's irrelevant. I mean, it's not less a crime to beat a small child than it is a large one. And, of course, we were more developed back then. But, again, that's irrelevant. A four-year-old girl doesn't even have a developed reproductive system, but nobody thinks she's less valuable because of it. And, of course, we were in a different location, but that, too, is irrelevant. I mean, how does it follow that where we are has any bearing on who we are? When your listeners jumped in their cars today to begin the drive home, they changed location. Did they stop being themselves simply because they changed location? And if not, how does a journey of 8 inches down the birth canal suddenly transform a tissue blob into something we ought to respect? I think the Lacey Peterson case really exploited that lie for what it is. And, of course, some people will say we're too dependent. Well, you know, look, you brought up a good case, Todd. What about elderly people who are dependent on insulin or heart pacemakers? Do they cease to count because they cannot survive on their own? All of these reasons that people give for disqualifying the unborn work equally well to disqualify people outside of the womb.
You said early on in our conversation that the Newsweek article we've been talking about here, The War Over Fetal Rights, mm-hmm. Seems to be pretty fair and balanced when it comes to its treatment of the debate and laying out the elements of the debate. Is this headline that we find there in Newsweek on the right track when it talks about rights?
Well, when it asks the question, should a fetus have rights, it's a fair question. You know, we might say as pro-lifers, we would have preferred the question to be, why shouldn't a fetus have rights? But, you know, that's okay. I'll take it as is. At least it's raising the question, what makes you and I valuable? Are we valuable for what we are intrinsically, the way that Hadley Arkus argues in his sidebar? Or are we only valuable because we acquire a property like self-consciousness, the way that Bonnie Steinbeck argues? Well, what's interesting is, I mentioned just a moment ago that all these arguments used to disqualify the fetus work equally well to disqualify those outside the womb. Ms. Steinbeck says here that we're not persons in a moral sense until we have self-consciousness or self-awareness. Well, the problem with that is newborns don't have self-awareness. See, her argument proves too much. It not only disqualifies the unborn, it disqualifies the newborn. And this is exactly what Abraham Lincoln argued when he would debate the issue of slavery. He'd say, look, you're going to disqualify the black man because his skin is dark? Well, take care. By that rule, you're going to be a slave to the first person you meet who has skin lighter than your own. Are you going to disqualify the dark man because he's less intelligent than you are, said Lincoln? Well, you better be careful again, because by that standard, you're going to be a slave to the first person you meet with an intellect superior to your own. In other words, Lincoln was showing that there was no ground in principle that would work for disqualifying the black man that wouldn't work equally well to disqualify the white man. And we've just seen that here with what, as applies to abortion, with what Ms. Steinbeck is arguing. She says self-consciousness is what matters. The fetus doesn't have it, therefore it means it has no value. Well, by that same standard, the newborn has no value. Nature magazine reported last fall that newborns have no self-awareness until around 9 months after birth.
One last question with only 1 minute. When I'm sitting at the water cooler, should I assume that the burden of proof lies with me in arguing for the full humanity of the fetus?
It doesn't philosophically. The burden is shared equally by both sides. But given our cultural mindset, practically it may reside with you. And sometimes asking good questions like, what makes human beings valuable? Why are you valuable as a individual? These can get the ball rolling and give you a chance to make a case for intrinsic human worth, which is really what this whole thing is about.
Scott Klusendorf, thank you very much for giving us your time and being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thanks, Todd.
Scott Klusendorf is Director of Bioethics for Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California. He's authored that book called Pro-Life 101. You can check out the website for Stand to Reason. Go to our website, issuesetc.org. There's a section there titled Links with Regular Guests. Click on that, and as you scroll down, you'll find a link to Greg Kokel and Stand to Reason. Or, if you'd like to receive this free Solid Ground newsletter, call Stand to Reason at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. When we come back from this break, we'll change subjects and guests. Joining us here in Studio A, Pastor Phil Lockus. We'll be talking about a biblical overview of Christian ethics, in particular, Christian ethics in the workplace. He's one of the co-authors of our Issues Etc. book of the month for June, called Christian Ethics in the Workplace. And we'll be asking this question: if we can establish a biblical standard for Christian ethics, do we need something like business ethics? We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.